there! You are listening to the Conservation Spotlight, a regular segment of Willamette Wake Up on KMUZ Community Radio, 88.5 and 100.7 FM, and streaming at KMUZ.org. This is where Marion and Polk Soil and Water Conservation Districts and OSU Small Farms Program shine a light on partnerships and programs that conserve our beautiful natural resources in the Willamette Valley. We're illuminating our collective mission of conserving soil, water, and natural resources for urban and agricultural audiences in the Willamette Valley.
I'm your host, Delaney Herb, Natural Areas Conservation Planner, the Marion Soil and Water Conservation District. On today's episode, we're talking with Owen Dell, author of Sustainable Landscaping for Dummies. Owen is not only an author, but is an internationally recognized landscape architect, certified master water auditor, certified permaculture designer, and educator. He is the principal of Owen Dell & Associates, LLC out of Corvallis, Oregon, and has been part of the landscape community since 1971. He has also traveled all over the United States and Canada to deliver lectures on sustainable landscaping. Today, we will be discussing sustainable landscaping in your yard and what you can do to keep your yard thriving with less. Have you ever wondered how to keep your grass green without runaway water, or the best landscaping techniques for minimal disturbance? How about the easiest plants to keep your yard looking manicured without the hassle? Well, that's exactly what we're going to help you with on this week's show.
Hi, good morning, Owen. Thanks for being here. As we get started, why don't you tell everyone listening a little about yourself?
Okay. Well, thank you for having me. First of all, I appreciate the opportunity. I think my story with regard to horticulture starts in my childhood when I grew up in San Francisco, and I was living mostly virtually across the street from Golden Gate Park, one of the most beautiful and naturalistic parks in the world. And I took it for granted that that was my backyard. And it wasn't until many, many years later when I was driving through Golden Gate Park, long after I had moved away from there, that I realized that was really the genesis of my interest in horticulture. When I was in high school, we moved to Santa Barbara, and that's another garden paradise of the world. And I wasn't particularly interested in horticulture at that point in my life, but I ended up in botany class with some very good charismatic professors in college. And I really was taken with the world of nature. And there came a time when we started doing field trips this was in 1972. And it happened to be a banner year for wildflowers in California. And so we went to the desert and we went to the coast and we went up into the mountains and the Sierra Nevada and so forth. And I was just, I fell in love. I was just absolutely captivated. Well, the time came to do a final project. Everyone was instructed to do a plant collection, which means you pull things out of nature and smash them between sheets of botanical paper that is then put in a plant press, dried. And it felt wrong to me. I went to the professor and I said, you know, I really don't want to do this. And especially since everyone else is doing it, I'd like to do something alternative. So the professor said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd like to do a paper on landscaping with native plants. He said, sure, that's great. Go ahead. So we did. And in the course of that, at that point, I was married to the thing. I never looked back. And my friend Buddy and I decided we would start a landscaping business and do work with native plants. So long story short, I went from gardener to licensed landscape contractor, and eventually in the 1990s, at the urging of a friend of mine, to licensed landscape architect, which is what I do now. And for many years, I was both the licensed contractor and a landscape architect, and ran a firm in Santa Barbara, and then in 2012 moved to Oregon. And so for the last 10 years, I've been a licensed landscape architect here in Oregon.
What's been your favorite part of this transformation?
I think I would answer that question in a broad way by saying that as much as I love working with nature and bringing land into balance in some way, which is really the technical part of what I do, it's really about the people and the interface between human beings and nature. The things that they can do for nature by making changes on their property, and then the things, conversely, that nature can do for them. And we're part of an ecosystem. And I love going back to a project, seeing it mature, talking to the client, hearing about how much they've enjoyed the property, how much they've enjoyed the landscape. It really is transformational, and it's very moving to me.
And you're also an author. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your Sustainable Landscaping for Dummies book and how you decided to join the series of, you know, books for dummies?
Well, yes. I've been writing on sustainability issues and landscape issues and a certain amount of political interface with those things for decades. And I wrote for Sunset Magazine for a long time. I wrote for Pacific Horticulture, Southern California Gardener, This Old House. I've written a lot over many decades in various publications. So I was kind of coming up to the radar, on the radar of various publishers. And in the early 90s, I was asked to write a book about the business of landscaping. And that is now in its seventh edition. After all these years, it's still in print. It's called How to Start a Home-Based Landscaping Business. At some point, one of my editors from Sunset Magazine got me involved with the Dummies series and wanted me to write gardening for dummies. This is back in the 80s, late 80s. And they were going to have Paul McCartney write the introduction. And I guess he's very into gardening. It all looked wonderful, except they weren't offering me a very good deal on it. So I turned it down and I walked away. And then years later, I get contacted by Wiley, who had bought the Dummies series from this other publisher in Chicago. They asked me to develop a proposal for Sustainable Landscaping for Dummies, which was much more up my alley. It took me about a year to put this together. It's gotten the word out there to thousands, tens of thousands of people in a way that hopefully makes the world a better place.
So now that you've told us a little bit about your Sustainable Landscaping for Dummies book, can you tell us what sustainable landscaping looks like?
Yeah, that's a really important question because people think it looks different than other landscaping somehow, that it's very special and maybe it's a lot of gravel or something. And we have to go back to the damage that was done in what was called the xeriscape era when we were all about saving water, particularly in California and Colorado in the 80s. And that was a good thing because water is definitely one of the key elements in a landscape, and it's definitely mismanaged. And during that period, there was a lot of advice that you should take out plants and put in rock and gravel and mulch and cactus, and people hated it, and they really got the wrong idea. When we moved into sustainable landscaping, which is really a much bigger envelope of interrelated things, water being one of them, but many, many other things as well, we're still fighting that belief system. Well, sustainable landscaping doesn't look really it doesn't look particularly different than ordinary landscaping. Maybe there's less lawn. Probably there is. Depends on where you are. Now, here in the Pacific Northwest, particularly in the Willamette Valley in Western Oregon, a small amount of lawn is fine because it grows naturally here. We're the epicenter of lawn seed production. It doesn't mean we should have acres of lawn, but less and manage more intelligently. But if we look at the rest of the landscape, well, what's it about? It's about plants. It's about places to live and enjoy your life and entertain. And there'll be shade from the trees. There'll be flowers. There'll be beauty, obviously beauty. There's no need to sacrifice beautiful landscaping in order to have sustainable landscaping. That's a false dichotomy. sustainable doesn't mean all native necessarily, although native plants are a big element. Look at the beautiful native plants that we have in this area. I mean, we have so much to pick from, ferns, and then you look at other plants that are not native to here, that are native to similar habitats, ecosystems throughout the world that are imported here, and those are also beautiful. So there's less, probably less turf. And by the way, that doesn't mean you can't have a meadow-like look. And we've developed a lot of alternatives to the typical mowed lawn, such as, you know, wildflower meadows, which are a little bit tricky, or sedge meadows. There have been some really interesting developments in that. Sustainable landscaping is about function. It's not about appearance. It's about how does this little ecosystem, a synthetic ecosystem that we have created intentionally, how does it work? How does it function? Does it function like a natural ecosystem? People don't manage wild places that much compared to what gardeners do. And I always say gardeners are control freaks. The ecosystem that we create is hopefully as internally stable, or as we use the word homeostatic, as possible, so that as it grows in and develops over a few years and matures, it becomes easier to take care of rather than harder to take care of, like so many other less well-designed landscapes. So it's really just about doing it right. You know, it's not anything particular. It's about things like, for example, giving plants room to grow. If a plant is going to get 6 feet tall, and you wanted it to be 3 feet tall, you can either plant it and cut it back constantly, because plants will never learn. You can't train a plant like you can train your dog or something. Or you can plant something that's more appropriate that only gets 3 feet tall. And just that one thing in itself can take you a long way towards sustainability. And then you add in pest and disease resistance of the plants. You add in longevity of the plants, obviously plants that are able as much as possible to thrive on natural rainfall, which we have plenty of here, especially this year. And then you start looking at the hardscape elements, which are things like patios and decks, and paving, and you begin to apply some principles to that are about sourcing materials responsibly and doing things without huge impacts offsite, which people don't think about. If every time you pour concrete, you've taken part in strip mining for aggregate, strip mining for the materials for the Portland cement, you've taken part in releasing tremendous amounts of CO2 into the air, and you've created something that in most cases, once its useful life is done, it becomes rubble for the landfill. It's really not a very responsible thing to do, but there are alternatives to that. And so it's not just about plants. It's also about all the other elements that go into a typical suburban or urban landscape. And we really look at everything so that the whole package has as few negative impacts as possible and as many positive impacts as possible. What does the landscape do? It brings pollinators around to your property. It creates food for you. It sequesters carbon. It creates shade and keeps your house cool in the summertime. You know, I could go on and on. So it's not about looks as much as it is about how does it work and what does it do for you and what does it do for the environment.
Now, I know your office is based in Corvallis, and there's a lot of new residents going in there. Do you work with HOAs or the homeowners associations? Have you had any issues with people wanting to do more sustainable landscaping and HOAs just not wanting that in their area?
Yeah, it's, I don't want to get in trouble here, but most of us in this profession don't like to work with HOAs. Some of them are fine, but, and I appreciate, by the way, the intention of having an HOA to bring some kind of consistency, because when you have individual homeowners, most of whom have no idea how to deal with land, they're going to make a lot of mistakes and they're going to do a lot of things and it's going to result in a lot of problems. So I get it. And I'm willing to work with anybody that wants to create a successful, not only individual environment, property by property, but also the larger environment of the neighborhood, and then, of course, the region, the community, and so forth. On the other hand, HOAs can be difficult because they're oftentimes run by people who have a little bit of power and abuse it. We had a case a few years ago where we wanted to put in, and this is not a native plant, but clumping bamboo to do a screening from in between two houses. And this, people hear bamboo and they think, oh my gosh, that's terrible. You know, it's just going to run all over the place. And there are plenty of running bamboos that cause problems. This was not one of those. And the HOA person who was doing plan review just said, no bamboo. And I said, well, this is, here are the benefits of this particular one, and this is what it'll do. Nope, no bamboo. And so, you know, it was just an impasse. So we did something else. That was fine. But they're not always particularly, they're certainly not always committed to sustainability, and they're not always really very experienced with the work that we do. So in theory, I think HOAs are great and are a unifying element with imperfections.
Maybe we can get more HOAs on board with the sustainable landscaping moving forward. And you recently were a speaker on our monthly First Friday series, and I know you mentioned the term hydrozone. Could you explain a little bit about what that is and how it's beneficial?
Hydrozoning is very interesting. It's not a concept that is in the public conversation, and in fact, it's not one that even among the professions is particularly well understood. Every plant has a particular water requirement. So a native plant, by the way, not all native plants are drought tolerant, especially here. Obviously, we have wetland plants that would not do well in dry conditions. So it's not reasonable to say, well, if it's native, it's drought tolerant. No, it's not like that at all. Similarly, not all non-native plants are high water use. It just depends. So we have all these plants, whether they're native or non-native, and we're thinking about picking some of them to create a landscape. And we're always pulling from thousands of plants to do whatever's necessary on a particular project. We need some trees, we need some shrubs, we need something to hide the view of the neighbors. We need some perennials, we need some food growing plants, maybe we need some kind of turf or turf-like planting. And then we have to pull all this together into some kind of highly functional whole. So there's a lot to that. And one of the elements of that, one of the elements that's very critical, is this idea of hydrozoning. And it's probably self-explanatory when you think about hydrozoning, water and zoning. Where do the plants go? Well, the whole idea boiled down is very simple. You take the stuff that likes a lot of water and you put it over here, and you take the stuff that likes it to be dry and you put it over there. You don't mix them together, because if you do and you have a high water use plant next to a low water use plant, you're either going to overwater the low water use plant and kill it, or underwater the high water use plant and kill it. So you have to physically zone those plants, separate those plants into areas of higher and medium and lower water use. And hopefully you will have not too many high water use things, especially going forward with climate change and global warming. It's clear that Western Oregon, along with every place else, is going to get hotter. The water supply is probably going to get dicey at some point, because snowpack, which is what we depend on, will melt off much quicker in a hot summer. It's happened last year, where you have a good snowpack and then it's 110 out and it's gone. So we're more precarious here than we think we are, which is very important to really understand. So not too many high water use plants, which means we're going to phase away from a lot of the things that have been part of the traditional makeup of the Pacific Northwest landscapes, azaleas, rhododendrons, and all that. Not zero, but fewer of them, placed in their own space. And then we're going to use more resilient things that will take hotter and drier, and that will survive even if we're not allowed to irrigate in drought years. And so everything is zoned. Now, the next step is that when you water according to the zone. And so the amount and frequency of watering is going to be greater in the high water use zone than it is in the dry zone, which might be never, you know, as opposed to twice a week or something. If you have an irrigation system, then you valve those areas so that each hydrozone has its own valve and its own system, whether it's drip or sprinkler. And that's a big story in itself, by the way. And then you can manage those separately, whether it's manual valves that you turn on and off, or it's on a controller that does it automatically. And, you know, really that's it. It's a very simple idea. And if you carry it out, your plants are going to be happier. They're going to do better. You're going to use less water. And you're not going to have as hard a time making things work.
Could you give us a few examples of the species you're seeing do better with the drier conditions we're seeing, or areas for those drier hydrozones?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, in our work, we're trying to anticipate what we think might happen in the future with regard to global warming. Now, the prediction for Oregon, Western Oregon, is it'll be wetter, interestingly, because we'll have more weather and possibly more and bigger storms, but it'll also be hotter. So there's a thing called evapotranspiration, which is a measure of the evaporation of water off the soil plus the transpiration of water through the plants, which is higher in a high water use plant. It's higher when it's hot, it's higher when it's windy, it's higher when it's dry, and it's lower when all those things are the reverse. Okay, so that's the basic thing. So what are we going to do to select plants that will not only be happy now, but that will be happy going forward, so that we don't find out that 5 years from now or 10 years from now, our landscape, which should have had a design life of 20, 30 years or more, is suddenly in trouble because we can't water it anymore. Okay. So what do we do? Well, one of the things we're doing is starting to bring plants from Southern Oregon up into the valley here, because if you look at the ecology that's happening, the changes in the ecosystems globally, plants, native plants and native plantings and ecosystems and biomes are moving northward. They're succeeding in the north and they're failing in the south. And that's a kind of way of all the systems, the forests and everything, walking their way north because of the temperature change and the lack of water. And Southern Oregon is a perfect example of that. It's bone dry down there right now, and we up here are not really in that much trouble, especially with the kind of rains that we've had just this recent spring. But we're moving up things like manzanita. Manzanita is a gorgeous plant. Most people are familiar with it. There are dozens, if not hundreds, of cultivars, that is, cultivated varieties, hybrid selections, as well as the native manzanitas. They're available spottily in the trade, meaning not that many people are growing them up here. We're trying to work on that. And there's a long history of success with manzanitas in the Pacific Northwest that people don't know about. In fact, there was a test garden in Aurora that OSU's Extension Service had until just recently, and they planted several hundred manzanitas and let them grow for many years. I don't know how old it was. And wow, it was fantastic. Almost all of the varieties, and they picked everything they could possibly lay their hands on and brought varieties up from California and Southern Oregon. And they almost all of them were beautiful and thriving in our heavy soils and wetness. You wouldn't think that a manzanita would like that because they're mainly chaparral plants. Well, they did fine. We use them on almost all of our projects now. They do fine. And that's an example of something that everybody loves. It's also a tremendous pollinator attractant. Those flowers, the bees just love them, native bees as well as honeybees. And they're easy and they're long-lived, they're fast-growing. I mean, it's a total home run. So that's one example. But there are certainly other things down there as well. Different oaks that are native to that area are going to come up here and are already creeping up into the area naturally. So why not use those? Why not use things like ceanothus, which is a native shrub that is beautiful again and has its place. And there are some native ceanothus in the southern part of the Willamette Valley. and we want to see them creep up. So we're kind of helping nature in its trek, its emigration, if you will, northward, by choosing some of those plants, and also maybe saving them from a terrible fate as Southern Oregon gets hotter and drier.
Well, it sounds like I need to put a few manzanitas in my yard this year. I love them. And I know, as you mentioned, this spring has been very wet. As it's now June, what are a few things folks could do in their yard that maybe are a little bit on the smaller end, where it's already June, we're already getting warm, but we'd like to start introducing sustainable landscaping into our yard without redoing, the whole yard in June?
Yeah. Well, and of course, June is not a great time to plant, although you can do it. It's better to plant in fall or spring. But you can plant in the summer. So it's really a time to, first of all, rethink your yard. So go out and try to understand what you have, identify the problem spots, and work on those, just like any other project in life. And then begin to develop a strategy first. It's going to look beautiful if you do things right. But it's also, again, about building that function into the landscape and understanding it as an ecosystem rather than just a bunch of plants that look good together. So things like hydrozoning, of course, come into that. There's a lot more to it. Let's talk about how to get through the summer, first of all, because, who knows? We could have another 112 or whatever it was, 116 degree summer thing, and that'll just beat up a lot of plants. So let's talk a little bit about water management, first of all. So I put together a handout and made a talk out of it, and it was about how to save water on three levels, having to do with cost, because I thought, people tend to approach a lot of things in life, whether of necessity or just preference, about money. How much does a thing cost? Well, when you talk about building a resilient landscape, you first of all have to look at what's the resilience that's already inherently there, and am I really optimizing my management for what I have, regardless of whether we change things or not? So the first level is little or no cost. So what do you do without spending any money to reduce water and probably make your plants happier? Well, first of all, just don't water as much. Learn how to manage water and understand when you need to water. Most people have no clue about that. It's a hot day, it's windy, they look outside, the plants are doing fine, but it's the surface of the soil is dry, and they say, well, I guess I better water. That's the commonest thing. Not necessarily. And if I were to go outside and move the mulch out of the way in my yard, it would be sopping wet, right? I mean, because we have had so much rain. And that rain will stay and stay and stay in the ground. We have clay soils. And, if you don't look at the soil, if you just look at the surface and you water based on that, or you water based on temperature, that's not really the right way to do it. So check soil moisture before watering. I have a professional grade, it's very inexpensive, moisture meter that I walk around and poke into the soil. I mean, I've been doing this for over 50 years, and I can't look at the surface of the soil and know whether it needs watering or not. So I poke this around different places, and the little meter, the needle goes up or down, and I figure out what areas need to be watered. Some areas are hot and sunny, and maybe the soil texture is a little different. The plants are demanding more water, or they're under a tree and the tree is sucking water out of the ground this time of year. And those areas are going to need water sooner than a place that's on the north side of a building that doesn't have tree roots in it and it's going to stay wet for months. So you have to understand where you are and then make watering decisions based on the truth, not just on supposition. So it takes a little bit of effort, but what you find out is you've been watering way too much. So you must understand what do your plants need to get through that water window of June, July, August, September, sometimes even into October. Now, there are a few other things. Repairing leaks, checking everything, make sure things aren't leaking. Don't hose off pavement, sweep it instead of hosing it, or blow it off if you have to. I'm not big on blowers, but that's another option. Watering early in the morning rather than in the heat of day. The plants like it better and it reduces evaporative losses. Water to the depth of the root system. Now, the roots of most things, including trees, are in the top 18 inches of soil, and they're very extensive. They go far beyond the drip line or the crown of the plant, and that's especially true of trees. Big trees are taking most of the water in your yard, not the plants that you have underneath them. So understand that we want to water, depending on the plant, between 6 and 18 inches deep. There's no point in watering 3 or 4 feet deep. You're just throwing the water away. It's going down to the water table and you paid for it, and that's pretty silly. So where are your roots? What's growing on? And go from there. Keeping weeds down doesn't cost you anything other than labor, and those use water and compete with the plants. If you have a lawn, you can let it go dry, which a lot of people in the valley do here. Of course, it's ugly then, and it's, again, you're outside and you want to have a nice lawn, and it's brown, and you know, heck, we wanted it to be green. And that's why we're switching to meadows and things, and that's a long story in itself. You can also mow the grass higher if you are watering, and that tends to reduce water use to some degree. And make sure that your sprinkler system, if you have one, is working properly. It's not leaking, that it's not watering the sidewalk, that the distribution uniformity of the system is such that it's really covering and you're not overwatering everything to cover one dry spot in the lawn because you really just need to adjust your heads or something. So those are all free things or things that cost very little. And then moving up into things that cost a little bit, but not too much. Replace high water use plants, replace low ground covers because they allow weeds to come in and they allow, I mean, they don't shade the soil much, so they dry out much more quickly. And most of those low ground covers take a lot of water. Reduce your lawn areas. Maybe you have too much. Do you really need that giant lawn, especially in the front yard where nobody ever uses it? It's just there for looks. Well, why not replace it with something that's needs less water and provides more ecosystem services to the bees and the birds and all the other good things. Mulching. Mulching is super important. It doesn't cost very much. We are using more and more wood chips, or what they call arbor chips, which is tree trimmer chips that come out of the chipper. It keeps the soil temperatures even. If you have a drip system, it hides the drip tubing, keeps the weeds down, it looks good, and so forth. Mulching is a huge essential element to a sustainable landscape. If you have sprinklers, consider converting them to a drip system because that can reduce water by half or more. If you have an automatic system, you can install a rain sensor, which shuts the system off during rainfall. And then we have major investments where you really just need to change your whole landscaping because it's just so bad that, you know, or you're tired of it anyway or whatever, or you have a new house. So taking care of the soil by inoculating mainly with living soil biological organisms like mycorrhizal fungi, which help to reduce water use and increase the vigor of the plants. Adding organic matter to the soil is good as long as you don't overdo it much. It's actually more about the life of the soil through biology than it is about changing the texture of the soil by bringing in a whole lot of compost or mulch. Those things are good, but most people tend to overdo that. And then converting, obviously, to drought-adapted plants, or choosing a water-conserving lawn seed mix, which is another option that you have. Even though it's a traditional lawn, it's grasses that use somewhat less water. Possibly harvesting rainwater with a tank or using gray water. And then maintenance. Maintenance is huge. How do you manage the landscape intelligently so that you're not overwatering, so that you're not allowing things to get out of control? A well-designed landscape is going to get easier and easier to maintain as it matures and it becomes that homeostatic ecosystem that we're really striving for. Well, I guess to end on a positive note, I would just say, you know, all the things we've been talking about are doable by anybody. There's not a great deal of mystery to it. It does involve, you know, obviously on a technical level, it involves quite a bit to actually put these things into practice. And I also have a lot of information on my website, which is owendell.com. It's a good place for people to start, or they could buy my book, Sustainable Landscaping for Dummies.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Owen, for taking some time with us today.
I've been talking with Owen Dell about conserving water in your yard and the best landscaping for lowering your water use. I'm your host, Delaney Herb, Natural Areas Conservation Planner with Marion SWCD. Thank you for taking a few minutes to share your light with us. We are grateful for our community of conservation-minded folks who know the importance of partnerships. If you would like more information on this topic, please visit our website, marionswcd.net, and our Facebook page for follow-up information. The Marion SWCD has a monthly program called First Fridays, where each month we talk with a different expert about all things conservation. And if you like what you heard here on the Conservation Spotlight, tune in next month to KMUZ at 100.7 or 88.5 FM, the third Wednesdays during Willamette Wake Up. Thanks for listening, and keep your light shining.